Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of March 6th, 2016. This is Jack Bresset Mills. Conversation today with Patrick, old friend. But first, the verses I wrote for Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul for his week 49. This one I wrote 2 years ago. Verse 49. As my clarity of thought recalls its own growth through the world's darkest nights, it turns with hope toward the new dawning and feels a benevolent force, the living being of the earth. And this one I wrote last year for the same Rudolf Steiner verse, 49a. When I quiet and clear my mind, I feel the being of the world coming alive, awakening from its winter, and, like a rising sun, hope streams through me. Yeah, Patrick and I knew each other 20 years ago or so. I haven't talked to him since. I knew he was in Washington, and I knew he knew economics, associative economics. I looked it up. It's what they call economics thought based on Rudolf Steiner's ideas. And so I was asking him about these things. We talked a long time. I've cut out 20 minutes for you. Hope you like it. Here you go. Thanks, Patrick.
With respect to the environment, that it's in no one's interest to keep running the world to the detriment of that which supports it, the whole environment. It can also have the idea that we cannot run our financial system in a way that ultimately is self-destructive and full of contradictions. And that one of the key insights into that, I think, is why someone holds wealth, has an investment, you know, what their need to do so is important. And so for those who don't really have a need for it, it's actually not in anyone's interest for them to continue to hold it. That creates, you know, a financial system that's overly financialized and is overly abstract and is top heavy and is very fragile. And that's what we have. So one way of saying that is, well, the wealthy just have too much wealth that needs to be redistributed. But if that is done out of economic insight instead of out of kind of jealousy or envy, then it's a very different dynamic, I think.
Totally. And throughout history, it's always been push the poor as far as you can until they break in and tear everything down and rip everything apart. And then what happens? They don't make some equal, wonderful utopia after that. They are jealous and they want to be rich now. They're going to do everything they can. The poor want to become rich too then. So it's just one jealousy after the next. It's very, very, very sick. I mean, the genius of our system is that there are enough benefits given to the middle that they kind of keep everything going. They keep the very poor from revolting, and the rich can keep their money. And I mean, that's really quite a genius thing that we've had for a couple hundred years that doesn't really exist anywhere else. I mean, for so long, to really allow so many rich people to not be overwhelmed by the jealous poor. It's quite an amazing system we have, that it hasn't been torn down yet, but it's coming close. It really comes close now. And then it happened in the 30s. It happened 100 years ago. And now it's happening again. It's just really close, where people are almost ready to start tearing everything down. And they're tired of this inequality. And so maybe there's a little giving over and maybe there's a little distribution. But it's at its core, it's not a fair thing. It's not thought out. It's really not thought out at all.
Right. And the usual, the almost universal solution that is at least pointed to in the media and by politicians is for, you know, a new deal, for another kind of government solution.
Spreading it around.
Yeah, through you know, more taxes.
Yeah.
So that's really just trying to prop up the system a little longer.
Yeah.
Make it a little more social.
Yeah.
But if there were, you know, if there is, as there must be, you know, another great crisis, and there are real powerful ideas, and also, I think importantly, some real practical initiatives that point to what a truly healthy economy would look like, then there might be a possibility for that to kind of catch on more so.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Steiner was, of course, trying for after World War II, with his idea of the threefold nature of the social organism, and then later when he gave his lectures on economics in 1922.
Yeah, and you misspoke. I think you meant after World War I. But
yes, of course. Yeah.
But I'm so happy that he gave these pictures, because they can just simmer. People like you, 100 years later, can be reading them and going, "Hey, this is good. This actually is good. This might work, you know." But how does it percolate up? I wonder if there are more people, or the same, or less people today that know these ideas than in Steiner's day. He had a lot of people following his words. 100 years later, I wonder if it's less or more, or about the same number of people who know what he was talking about.
Yeah, I certainly don't know.
Yeah.
The economics course is the most important for our time, for the West and for our time. And some people have said that it's impossible to understand the economics course. But I think, you know, people are kind of working at it and getting more and more insight into it, seeing just such a wealth of, you know, just as with everything in Steiner, what he's calling for, a living thinking, you know, a new kind of thinking.
Yes.
And the way that he gives the lectures is calling for that living thinking. So in order to be a match for it, you're challenged to, you know, to read the lectures and not say, "Oh, this is a mass of contradictions," but to say, "Well, actually, it's my thinking that's inflexible, and if I have a more flexible living thinking, then I can actually see how this is a description of this great organism exists or could exist." So, you know, that, you know, it's a challenge to really come up with a new living thinking, and to the economics course is there for people to try to understand.
I don't know that he mentions it there, but I got the picture once, this idea of an Aramonic thought. And of course, that's a catchphrase. You could say that's a cool thing to think of. But for example, if you want to go help someone, and you enjoy helping them, and you had fun helping them today, and then you're going home, and they say, "Well, how much do I owe you?" And you say, "No, that was great." They go, "No, you've got to get paid for your time." That, I think, is an Aramonic thought. You don't have to, at least not with money. Your time can be your choice. You can choose to take money for your time, or you can choose to enjoy your life. And maybe it's one or the other. It seems today, it seems at least that it is one or the other, that we are paid for things we don't like to do. And then when we're doing something we like, we usually aren't paid. But I'm very often working and not being paid. And I love it. And so I'm constantly having to explain to people that, no, this is fine. I actually have to act like I'm wealthy, because otherwise people will insist on paying, or at least being uncomfortable with me working, so-called working. So there's these ideas around that are an old, dead kind of a thinking. And where did they come from? Who, to the idea that Ahriman gave us these thoughts, it makes it kind of dramatic and kind of cool, but I don't know that that's necessarily a part of it. But just to think, where is our thinking dead? Where are we hanging on to ideas that do not actually live? It's really important to try to weed those out of your own brain.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is.
You talked about the age of money or something about the life.
Yeah.
The idea
the age
that,
of money.
That money, yeah. That money is sitting somewhere is getting less valuable. And we do that. We do that through the interest rate and the cost of living and all that kind of stuff. We do it separate from the money in a way. We know that our money, we know that our money is aging, but somehow is it better to actually have a date on every dollar bill, you know, and show that, oh, this is an old dollar bill. We got to get rid of this. This is getting all stinky. We got to get rid of this dollar bill. Is that better? Is that more living? You know, that kind of idea. Which is the better idea, that we have an interest rate or that we have the money with a date on it?
Well, I don't think, I think interest rates, Steiner says, you know, he's not saying there would not be interest rates. But I think the cost of living, inflation, that does point to where the money is kind of outwardly growing older. The smell is kind of, instead of being internalized in the age of the money, it's kind of having its effect outwardly.
Yeah.
But it's not just that. It's not just inflation. It's also that once you have money as kind of this immortal object, then the power shifts to it. So those who possess it can kind of call the shots, and it's no longer a healthy economy. So, you know, it tilts the tables against people who to contribute and work. So to get at the root of that, you do need to have some way for it to age. But I think, you know, the way Steiner said in the economics course is, you could say, out of date, since, you know, paper money is almost out of date. You know, he speaks about actually having, as you said, an expiration date on a physical paper note.
Yeah.
And that,
it doesn't work.
You know, that wouldn't work. But I, to me, you know, I used to spend a lot of time thinking about how, and I'm no expert on it, and that's maybe dangerous when you have dilettantes thinking about things. But nonetheless,
you gotta try.
I'm interested and I give it a try. But, you know, to try to figure out how that would work.
Yeah.
But it's now, I think that the focus on this external kind of architecture that would heal the economy or certainly play a big part in healing it, I think is kind of the wrong approach. It can lead to the notion that we don't need to gain greater insight ourselves and create the social forms that allow us to have that greater insight. We just need to kind of tinker at some of the technologies, you know, the money technology, as it's called nowadays, that exist and to facilitate commerce.
I was wondering if maybe because you live near Washington or in Washington, you have more of an access to the idea that what people do actually can affect large numbers of other people. Where I am and where I live, if I think I can affect one person, even slightly, in a week, I'm amazed that I actually made one person feel better or happier or smarter. You know, I'm a tutor, I'm a teacher, but if I ever think I'm actually affecting anybody, it's pretty rare. But I think people in Washington actually go there thinking they can actually do something, and then they end up actually doing something that affects large numbers of people. I've always been impressed by people who actually have these ideas that go greater than themselves. It's really wonderful that there are people like you thinking of these things. I hardly ever. I mean, if I think of how, if I hire someone, for example, to work with me, I'll right away say, look, here's $100. I'm not going to care how long you work for me. I've just given you $100, and now I don't have to worry about it anymore. I'm free. Now I'm free. I don't feel any guilt about you being here. It's up to you now to be here as long as you like today. And that ends up working up real well. Every day they come, I pay them in the first moment I see them. And then it's up to them whether they work hard or not or stay long. And so in my own little way, I've got my own little economy that works for me, and I feel good about it and they feel good about it. But to think that I could come up with ideas for other people to have economies and whole nations and worlds, it's so amazing to think that people are actually doing that kind of thinking. It's wonderful.
There's a prejudice, I think, in people who are interested in alternative ideas and in kind of making the world better. There's sometimes, I guess I would say, it's either one or the other. Sometimes it's, well, we just need better policy and that will create the solution, because individuals are, you know, just need to be kind of put, have the right structures, and then things will work. And then there's the other extreme of everything has to kind of come from the grassroots, and companies and the government are just part of the problem, and we kind of have to do away with them. So I guess I kind of think that, well, maybe this might trick into making me think that I haven't sold out completely, that maybe there is a role in organizations at the organizational level of bringing about, you know, being a leading edge of change at some point.
That's wonderful. I'm glad you're thinking these thoughts. You've made me think them too, then. I'm very happy. I have read that course, and I didn't think it was a mass of contradictions. I thought it was actually quite good. But
I think probably your living thinking is much better developed than many people.
Maybe.
Thank you again, Patrick. That was great to connect with you again. And thank you all for listening. Please try again next week. And if you have any comments, please let me know at reasoningwithanoptimist.net. This is Jack Brissett Mills. Bye-bye.